Are you improving outcomes with SpHb? Continuous SpHb monitoring provides real-time visibility to changes or lack of changes in hemoglobin concentration between invasive blood draws and has been shown in multiple studies to help clinicians improve outcomes. Visit Masimo.com to learn more. This podcast is sponsored by Masimo.
Hi, this is Evan Karish, Editor-in-Chief of Anesthesiology, with some highlights from the May 2021 issue, which was selected by the journal editors. I'll begin this month with the results of a survey. It was conducted among members of the American Society of Anesthesiologists to explore the important issue of physician burnout. Dr. Anushka Afonso of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and colleagues there and at Harvard Medical School conducted the study. Their objective was to improve our understanding of burnout in anesthesiologists. They also wanted to identify workplace and personal factors which are associated with burnout among anesthesiologists and to quantify those associations. As the pandemic began in March 2020, the authors used the Maslach Burnout Inventory Human Services Survey to assess burnout. Nearly 29,000 anesthesiologists were surveyed. Nearly 60% were found to be at high risk of burnout, and nearly 14% met the World Health Organization criteria for burnout syndrome, in which all three aspects of the Maslach burnout inventory were abnormal. Multivariable logistic regression modeling showed that burnout syndrome was most strongly associated with a perceived lack of support at home and particularly at work. Physician age was the only personal factor that was associated with burnout syndrome. The author suggested that focused workplace interventions may be effective in reducing burnout. This article was accompanied by an editorial entitled Burnout, The Other Pandemic. It was written by Dr. Steve Hyman, Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. The editorial notes that the study's novel because it's the first large-scale evaluation of burnout in anesthesiologists. The editorial also notes that the ability of anesthesiologists to perform a wide range of duties, particularly in the COVID era, and to contribute positively to financial well-being of hospitals, often comes at the steep price of anesthesiologists' own well-being. It also provocatively notes that institutions often turn a blind eye to dysfunctional workplace characteristics which exacerbate burnout and thus have negative employee consequences. And it challenges these institutions to spend less time holding wellness and resilience seminars and spending more time to correct the institutional causes of burnout. To address individual issues without addressing workplace issues does not provide a comprehensive solution to the problem. Our next study is a perioperative clinical trial. It was a double-blind randomized trial that tested the effectiveness of the opioid methadone and the N-methyl-D aspartate receptor antagonist ketamine to improve postoperative pain control. Dr. Glenn Murphy, then at North Shore University Health System and now at Illinois Masonic Hospital in Chicago, and colleagues elsewhere conducted the study. They tested the hypothesis that patients undergoing spinal fusion surgery who were given intraoperative and postoperative ketamine together with intraoperative methadone would use less hydromorphone on the first postoperative day compared with those who were just given intraoperative methadone alone. The authors randomized 130 spinal surgery patients. All the patients received methadone, 0.2 milligrams per kilogram ideal body weight intraoperatively. Half of the patients also received an intraoperative ketamine infusion, 0.3 milligrams per kilogram per hour, followed by ketamine infusion of 0.1 milligram per kilogram per hour for the first 48 hours postoperatively. The other half of the patients received a placebo infusion for 48 hours postoperatively. The primary outcome was postoperative day one intravenous hydromorphone use. Patients in the methadone plus ketamine group required less hydromorphone on postoperative day one, a median of 2 milligrams compared with 5 milligrams in the methadone-only group. They also used less hydromorphone throughout the entire 3-day follow-up period. Patients in the methadone-ketamine group also required fewer oral opioid tablets. Pain scores were lower in the methadone plus ketamine group at 23 of the 24 postoperative assessment times. Patient satisfaction scores were high in both study groups. The authors concluded that the combination of methadone and ketamine could be considered in patients having spine surgery. And this article is accompanied by an editorial entitled "Methadone and Ketamine, Boosting Benefits and Still More to Learn." The editorial was written by Dr. David Clark of Stanford University and I. The editorial notes that less is known about methadone and perioperative drug combinations compared with other opioids. Ketamine did appear to have boosted the effect of methadone. And the magnitude of the effect of adding ketamine to methadone was much greater than is commonly reported for adding ketamine to other opioids. While these clinical observations were important and interesting, the mechanism of the ketamine-methadone interaction, however, remains unknown. Our next study is also a perioperative clinical trial. This was a prospective, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial that explored optimal pain management following hip arthroplasty. Recently, the quadratus lumborum block has been proposed as an analgesic option. Dr. Sophia Margareta Brixell and colleagues at the University of Montpellier, France, conducted the study. They tested the hypothesis that the posterior quadratus lumborum block would result in less postoperative morphine consumption after hip arthroplasty compared with placebo. 100 patients scheduled for elective total hip arthroplasty were studied. 50 patients were randomized to receive a 30 milliliter injection of 0.33% ropivacaine posterior to the quadratus lumborum muscle prior to general anesthesia. 50 patients received an injection of normal saline in the same anatomical location. All patients also received a multimodal analgesic regimen consisting of acetaminophen, ketoprofen, and a morphine intravenous patient-controlled analgesia pump. The primary outcome was total intravenous morphine consumption in the first 24 hours. The results found no significant difference between the groups in 24-hour total morphine consumption. Similarly, pain scores did not differ between the groups. The authors concluded that the addition of a posterior quadratus lumborum block to a multimodal analgesic regimen did not reduce morphine consumption or pain scores among patients who had had total hip replacement surgery. Next, we have an observational study. It explored the impact of mechanical ventilation on expiratory muscles in mechanically ventilated patients who are in mixed medical surgical academic intensive care units. Dr. Zhonghua Shi of the Amsterdam University Medical Centers in the Netherlands and colleagues there and in China conducted the study. Their objective was to evaluate changes in expiratory muscle thickness during mechanical ventilation and to compare this to changes in diaphragm thickness. There were two sub-studies as part of the overall investigation. The first, a reproducibility study, tested the feasibility and reproducibility of expiratory muscle ultrasound. It investigated inter- and intra-rater variability of lateral abdominal wall muscle measurements in 30 mechanically ventilated patients. Then it assessed the effects of lung volume on expiratory muscle thickness. The second sub-study was a cohort study investigating the evolution of expiratory muscle thickness during mechanical ventilation in critically ill patients. It used the threshold values from the reproducibility cohort to evaluate these temporal changes. Muscle thickness remained stable in the majority of subjects, but muscle thickness did decrease in 22% of patients, and it increased in 12%. The authors of the investigation concluded that these changes were unrelated to changes in diaphragm thickness. Increased expiratory muscle thickness resulted from increased thickness of the fascia. This article was accompanied by an editorial. The editorial was written by Dr. Franco Laggi of Loyola University Hospital, entitled "Expiratory Muscles Neglected No More." Dr. Laggi notes that expiratory muscle thickness is important because these muscles are necessary for cough and for successful weaning from mechanical ventilation. It makes a strong case for the use of ultrasound imaging to assess expiratory muscle thickness in ventilated patients. Our next study is a sub-analysis of a multiple crossover cluster trial. The original trial examined the effects of supplemental intraoperative oxygen, and this looked at effects of supplemental oxygen on long-term postoperative mortality. Dr. Xilong Zhang of Shanghai Jiao Tong University in China and colleagues at the Cleveland Clinic conducted the study. The authors tested the hypothesis that supplemental oxygen increases the hazard for long-term mortality. The authors conducted a post-hoc analysis of a large multiple crossover cluster trial in which adults who had had colorectal surgery were randomized to receive either 30% or 80% inspired oxygen during general anesthesia. The authors assessed the effect of 30% versus 80% target inspired oxygen on long-term mortality. Among 3,920 colorectal surgeries, the incidence of death after a median of 3 years of follow-up was 14%, with 80% oxygen, and 15% with 30% oxygen. The authors concluded that supplemental oxygen does not increase mortality. Next, we have a complex animal study. It explored the extent to which implicit memory formation is possible under sedation. Dr. Nir Samuel of the Weizmann Institute of Science in Rehovot, Israel, and colleagues there and elsewhere in Israel conducted the study. They tested the hypothesis that the amygdala and dorsal anterior cingulate cortex participate in forging emotional and valence-driven memory formation, even under sedation with ketamine or midazolam. The primary outcome of the study was behavioral and neural evidence that suggested memory formation. The experiment used a classical tone odor conditioning task, which allows for invasive neural recording under sedation or anesthesia. The paradigm measures respiratory responses and does not require conscious volition, which makes it suitable as an implicit measure of learning and memory in awake, sedated, and anesthetized conditions. The study simultaneously measured conditioned inspiratory changes and changes in the firing rate of single neurons in the amygdala and the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex. The study was done in two non-human primates. The authors introduced an expected aversive olfactory stimulus during sedation with ketamine or midazolam and then tested retention after recovery. They found that aversive memory formation occurred in 26 of 59 sessions under sedation. They positively correlated single neuron responses in the amygdala and dorsal anterior cingulate cortex. And these were positively correlated between acquisition and retention. The authors also found that neural responses during acquisition under sedation were stronger in sessions exhibiting memory formation than those that did not. The firing rate of neurons in the amygdala and the dorsal cingulate cortex during memory acquisition under sedation predicted the memory retention response after sedation. These observations suggest that implicit memory formation can occur under sedation. Moreover, memory formation appeared to follow similar rules and engage the same structures and mechanisms as in the awake state. Next, our Clinical Focus review article this month considers the clinical applications of near-infrared spectroscopy monitoring in cardiovascular surgery. Dr. Charles Hogue and his colleagues at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago authored this review. They summarized the applications of cerebral oximetry monitoring for adult patients undergoing cardiovascular surgery. Near-infrared spectroscopy can provide a clinically feasible method for monitoring cerebral oxygen saturation. Cerebral oximetry has entered clinical practice in response to great concerns about the effects of neurologic complications on patient outcomes after cardiac surgery. But nevertheless, the adoption of this technology in the United States remains low. Other applications do continue to evolve, including monitoring during non-cardiac surgery, such as shoulder surgery in the beach chair position, or during one lung ventilation for thoracic surgery. The review suggests that limitations with the technology and inter-individual variations must be acknowledged, such that cerebral oximetry should be interpreted as a trend, not an absolute monitor. In addition, the current evidence is not sufficient to either prove or disprove that optimizing cerebral oxygen saturation during cardiac surgery can improve patient outcomes. New applications of cerebral oximetry might expand its clinical utility, such as patients undergoing extracorporeal membrane oxygenation and maybe a bedside monitor of cerebral autoregulation. And I'll close this month with a review article that explores whether alpha-1 antitrypsin is a key factor or a bystander in acute respiratory distress syndrome. Dr. Grace Hogan and colleagues at the Royal College of Surgeons in Dublin, Ireland, authored this review. They note that the acute respiratory distress syndrome is characterized by hypoxemia, altered alveolar capillary permeability, and a neutrophil-dominated inflammatory pulmonary edema. Despite decades of research, an effective therapy for this remains elusive. The ideal pharmacotherapy for acute respiratory distress syndrome should demonstrate antiprotease activity. It should also target injurious inflammatory pathways, all while maintaining host defense against infection. Other desirable traits would be a reputable safety profile, low possibility of off-target effects, and well-understood pharmacokinetics. The endogenous 52 kilodalton serine protease, alpha-1 antitrypsin, has the potential to be a novel treatment option for acute respiratory distress syndrome. The main function of alpha-1 antitrypsin is as an antiprotease, targeting neutrophil elastase in particular. But studies have also highlighted the role of alpha-1 antitrypsin in the modulation of inflammation and bacterial clearance. In light of the current pandemic, our need for a treatment for acute respiratory distress syndrome is even more pressing than ever. This need is even greater considering that alpha-1 antitrypsin has been implicated in the inflammatory response to SARS-CoV-2 infection. As always, I thank you for your interest in and your support of our journal. I hope that you'll use the information in this podcast, and particularly the information published in Anesthesiology, to guide and improve your clinical practice. I very much look forward to keeping you informed as Anesthesiology continues to publish important research and trusted evidence every month.
Monitor hemoglobin continuously and non-invasively with Masimo SpHb. Studies have shown that SpHb hemoglobin monitoring may help clinicians reduce blood transfusions in both low and high blood loss surgeries. Visit Masimo.com to discover how SpHb can help support your blood management initiatives. This podcast is sponsored by Masimo.